So today we concluded reading Parshas Naso. Because we read the pasuk Zos Chanukas HaMishkan, Chanukas HaMizbeach, so it's called Zos Chanukah. So this is a day called Zos Chanukah. It's the eighth day of Chanukah. And let's talk a little bit about some of the ideas that emerge in the Parsha. First of all, one idea which is not specific to today, but today was the cap-off. What makes Parshas Naso so long, 176 psukim? And the answer is obvious, because we have 12 Nesiim, and they each bring very, extravagant gifts. And the Torah lists their gifts, one by one by one. Everyone can read Parshas Naso. Karbana, karas kesef achas. A lot of silver, a lot of gold, a lot of spice, a lot of flour, a lot of oil, and a ton of animals. Just think about it. Parim, kivasim, si'irim, and just the shlamim, elim chamisha, tudim chamisha, kivasim enishana chamisha. Just the shlamim were 15. 15 times 12 felt like Tevas Noach. Now the question is, why does the Torah iterate every single karban? Try to trace in Sefer Bereishis, where the Torah describes in long detail and great verbosity information that could have been dispensed with through quick summaries, through succinct, this is what happened, these were the children of Esav, these were the generations, Eliezer got to Aram Naharaim and found Rivka. Why does the Torah indulge? You've got entire Mesechtos. How long have we spent learning? How many words have we really spoken about this year? Ki, Yikach, maybe, Ish, Isha, Bulas Baal, V'yatza V'haysa, V'halcha V'haysa, I mean, 7-8 words maybe in the Torah, and we haven't even begun to crack the iceberg known as Kiddushin. And I've got hundreds of psukim that seem to be redundant. So there's something deeper here. And I think what the Torah is describing is the uniformity. I can promise you that each Shevet and each Nasi had a different experience. Because, remember, we no longer have Shevet identity. They did. Sometimes when the Gabbai asks me, are you a Kohen or a Levi? I say, I'm a Yehuda. Like, Yisrael feels very drab, like I don't belong anywhere. I'm a Yehuda, I belong to Shevet Yehuda, maybe Binyamin. So I'm a Yehuda. Which means I can get the third Aliyah, but they had a really prominent Shevet identity. You belong to Naphtali, you were there for. You belong to Dan, you were there for. You lived in a certain area, you had a culture, you had certain foods, a dialect, marriage rite. And sometimes those Shevet identities flared, and you see how it created a lot of inner tension and splintering, specifically in Sefer Shoftim, specifically at the end of Sefer Shoftim, Pelegesh Begiva. But not just then. Sadly, we've lost Shevet identity. There was a base in Hagadol Shel Each Shevet, where it says in Sanhedrin, before you went to the Beis Din HaGadol Yishalayim, you could go to the Beis Din HaShevet. Beis Din HaGadol, like a Sanhedrin Kitana of each Shevet. So undoubtedly, each of these Nesiim were leading tribes, and these tribes had begun to develop tribal identity. What made me different? The fact that I belonged to Naphtali from someone who belonged to Gad. So their karbanos were all different. Their experiences were different. Their emotional associations and the emotional moment was different. But they didn't have to express those differences by diversifying the karbanos. They felt comfortable enough to all bring the same karban, not to arouse any external competition or any external looking over your shoulder and who's wealthier and who has more money. And the uniformity in no way diminished the personal authenticity. That to me is the message of the end of Naso. And that's really the challenge in particular in life, in general in life, and in particular this stage of life. You're all trying to find your identity. And that's really important, because the deeper your identity is, the deeper your experience is, and hopefully the deeper your experience, the deeper your Avodas Hashem, because Avodas Hashem should be the supreme experience. So if you really know who you are, and you build yourself as an individual, and you find your own voice, and you find your own self, and you're confident in your own self, you'll lead a richer life as a human being, and hopefully you'll lead a deeper form of avodas Hashem. How can I be a avodas Hashem? What makes me different from other people? And how can I take all those differences and be a better avodas Hashem? I'm not this, I'm not this, I am this, I'm not this. How can I take the thises that I do possess and turn them into a better service of the Ribono Shel Olam? It's hard for you now, because you're right at that stage where you're building your identity. A lot of people have a difficult time with their parents, in part because, you know, you feel like in your father's shadow, you don't want to be seen as your father's son, or it's a part of male identity. It's trying to, that's why males get married and leave their home, and it helps building yourself and your sense of self and earning a living. It's really crucial. So, and this yeshiva, I think, certainly strongly encourages that process. We don't try to herd you into one cookie-cutter image, the way you dress and the way you belong and the way... We want to try to help you become as best an Oved Hashem as you can, each in your own trajectories, in your own tracks, in your own worlds. I think this is highly individualized and highly personalized. Now, if I have to answer this question again on an interview, I think I'm going to shoot myself. You know, Rebbe, what's the afternoon? What's the schedule like in yeshiva? I'm giving interviews and I'm going to Zoom. So like, what's the schedule? I can't just record it and send it out. So my answer is, like, the schedule is pretty similar in all the yeshivas, you know, give or take a half an hour here and half an hour there. I would say the primary difference is afternoon Seder, where here it's a little more diversified. It's not as if everyone's learning Gemara. Some people are learning Gemara, some people are learning Tanakh, some people are different diversity, and it has its pros and cons. You have to decide which is best for you. Otherwise, whether we start chakras at 7 or 7, when I say in Gush, we start chakras at 8, we just start chakras. Anyway. But sometimes when you're trying to find your own identity, and especially during these years where you're not yet comfortable, it's important to be honest with yourself. You don't yet have identity. That's not meant to be deprecating. That's not a patronizing statement. That's just a biological developmental assessment. You're finding your identity, and hopefully some of you are further along, some of you are further behind. It's just a maturation process. Just like physiologically there's a process, there's an emotional process. Sometimes when you're fighting for your independent identity, it's harder to feel uniformity. And that will be something you'll challenge your whole life. In order for me to be different, I have to look different, I have to sound different, I have to dress different, I have to behave different, I have to stand out. And that's a very cheap way to find identity. How can you be like everyone else, just an average person, and everyone looks at you on the street and they don't see anything different, nothing to see here. You look the same, you dress the same, you walk in line, you're part of a community, you're not deviant, you don't try to... But deep down, you're your own person. And that's a really, really subtle struggle. I've seen people take very extreme positions, radical positions, always taking radical positions in conversations because they want identity, they want independence. They dress differently. You know, their clothing, their hair. Trying to draw attention. I want to feel different. That's not real independence. That's not real identity. That's just show. And by taking such staunchly independent and fiercely independent positions, you're depriving yourself of a lot of growth, because so much of growth is communal and joint and becoming that different person. I speak not just from knowledge. I speak from experience. Let me tell you two personal stories. And I'm proud of myself that I've worked hard at this. I'm not saying that I'm perfect at it, but I work at it very hard. When I was in yeshiva, this is a comical story, then I'll tell you a more existential moment. When I was in yeshiva, so I had a seder from 11:30 to 1:30. Forget when, Shana Aleph, Shana Bet. You know what my seder was in? No, that was my first year. It was creepy. Okay. You like hack me. Okay. My Seder, I think the second year was a very big Talmud Chacham. We learned Olas and Kalim. We plowed through Olas and Kalim at 11:30. And like, I don't know if I was conscious of it, probably was, if you ask me, why was I learning Olas and Kalim like an idiot? Because I wanted to be the only Shana Aleph guy in Israel learning Olas and Kalim. It was like, no one learned Olas and Kalim. I wanted to feel special. You know, that's a pretty, pretty harmless feeling, special, you know, choice of what to learn. But can you feel special without having to be deviant and divergent and stand out and be different? Again, that's not very public. It's not like I made announcements. It's not like I argued against those who wanted to learn Megillah. If you learn Megillah or Sanhedrin, you're a loser. And you're I just chose a mesechta, but you'll see a lot of people in the search for identity, they feel compelled to make themselves different with their externals, with their positions, with their views, with their sarcasm. So now the existential moment. Remember, I was with my friends at a Sheva Brachos. I don't think I was married yet, but I was at a Sheva Brachos of a friend of mine in a restaurant in New York City, an old Jewish restaurant that since has closed. It's an old, famous, anyone ever hear the following restaurant from your grandparents? Luigi Siegel's. It's like the old Shmulka Bernstein's and Ratner's. Like, well, there are five restaurants in New York City, and these are like meccas. Now you've got suburbs, so you've got restaurants in every suburb. In those days, there was no restaurants in the suburbs. For a restaurant, you went to Manhattan, and you dined in the three or four or five fancy-schmancy restaurants. So in this restaurant, there was Judaica art on the wall. This was a really, really hallowed, traditional Jewish restaurant. Gefilte fish and matzah balls and schmaltz and... No Mexican food there, I promise you. It was all traditional Ashkenazi food. There was a portrait on the wall, a famous portrait of Talmudic sages sitting around the table having a Talmudic conversation. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a very famous painting, I don't know who. And everyone was responding to the conversation differently. So someone in my group, a friend, says, well, who is each of us in that picture? Like, take each of us and try to associate each person here with someone in that picture. And like all my friends said to me, oh, that's you. And they pointed to this like person with a long white beard at the head of the table, and his feature was like this, like he was projecting there. And it was really hard for me. I said, that's not the way I want to be seen. It was a moment of truth, and it was very painful for me. Generally, the moments of truth are the ones that are most painful. I don't know if you've had them yet, but I could think back to like three or four times in my life where I realized the way I was being seen or heard, and I had no clue, and it was really hurtful to me because my whole world was turned upside down. And then after a day or two, I said, oh, that's great. Now I know how I can change because I know how people are seeing me. This is the best thing that ever happened to me. Best thing that ever happened is people who love me or something. I once overheard a conversation or was really hurt. Oh, that's really great. Now I know. Now I've got information. Like I know how I can improve because I know I'm being seen. I don't have to speculate or expostulate. I know how I'm being seen. So there were many parts of that moment for me, but one of it was like I was seen as almost like, that's what I'm looking for, renegade or different. Or I worked hard to maintain who I am as a person, have a healthy sense of self, healthy sense of identity, find my own way in life, not necessarily take the shape of my containers, that have deeper authenticity, but without having to stick out all the time, without having to be different and look different and draw attention. So that to me is the message of all these psukim in the end of Nasa. What about the beginning of Halosha? So two additional messages, both relating to the famous Rashi. Why is the menorah juxtaposed to the Nesiim? Famous Rashi, when Aaron saw all the Nesiim delivering the Korbanos, Nechlasha Daito. So the truth is there are two sub-messages here. One is, don't be lazy. Can't say that Aaron was lazy, but he said, let the Nesiim bring whatever materials they want and I'll fill up the gaps. I'll supplement it. It turns out that everyone delivered everything, which is really the Nesiim as well, and Aaron. So whenever there's a chance, take care of things quickly. Don't be lazy. Don't procrastinate. Don't wait for others. Don't wait for it to get done. I've told you a lot about procrastination in life is one of the great success blockers. If you procrastinate, especially things you dread doing, you're never going to get around to them. Procrastination is addictive. It's an endless cycle. You'll find greater reasons to procrastinate. Whatever is difficult and you have to attend to it, try to attend to it as quickly as you can, and you'll see it'll create great success. Not always easy, but you have to keep that little mental reminder in your mind. It's not going to get easier if I wait a week. It's going to get harder, more inertia, less momentum. I'll just take care of it now. But part of it is that Aaron could have given many excuses for his lack of delivering the matanos of the other Nesiim. He's a busy man. This is a busy day. This is a day of vindication. This is the day that ultimately his children will die. He doesn't know that yet. In Parshas Balosha, my Balosha is described as Rukas HaMishkan back in Shemini, before Shemini. But certainly emotionally, can't imagine Aaron slept too much the night before because this is the day of his great vindication from the Egel. He was the accomplice. He was certainly guilty. The Egel, Moshe was displeased with him. So he's been waiting months for this day. He's been waiting since Shavasar Batamos, basically three quarters of a year. You think of talk about quarantining for a couple of weeks. He's been emotionally quarantined since Shavuos Tamuz, since the Egel, waiting to see whether HaKadosh Baruch Hu would accept their kapara and would inhere or descend into the Beis HaMikdash. He's got a lot on his mind the week before. And he could be excused if he says, you know what, I'll take care of my business. They'll take care of the other business, specialization, divide and conquer. I can't take care of it all. But he realizes he's missing something. And instead of just brushing it aside and running away and acquitting himself and giving excuses, he feels bad. So this is a very interesting message to you. Do you have the ability in life to feel bad? And that's not so easy for people who are trained to feel good about themselves. That's not so easy. We talked a couple of weeks ago about people that have so much. When you have so much and you don't feel that you're lacking, your knee-jerk response when you see someone that has more than you is, okay, but you know, I ignore it, cognitive dissonance, I forget about it, sneak it under the carpet, I reject that person, I negate that person, I'm sarcastic to that person. These are all defense mechanisms against what you should be is feeling bad. So just think about coming into yeshiva. Okay, and you all came from high schools in which you were the hero of high school, valedictorian, top marks, top of your grade. And then you came to yeshiva, and I'm sure you met people that far surpassed whatever your accomplishments were in high school. And hopefully that made you feel a little bad. And that's a healthy feeling, to feel like I wish I had done more, I wish I could do more, I wish I could accomplish more. It shouldn't oppress you, it shouldn't tyrannize you. But that feeling in life of looking at people, sometimes I meet a Talmud Chacham and feel bad. Oh, you know, if I'd done a little bit more, I could have been a bigger Talmud Chacham. Or I feel bad. If I had worked a little harder, I could have better midos. Because when I look at someone's midos, I don't just say, oh, well, I have, and that person doesn't have what I have. And so these are healthy for me to feel bad and feel corrected. So it may seem like a little throw-in that Rashi says, but Aaron had a lot of excuses. He could have easily avoided feeling bad. Nechel Shadas. But Aaron makes a decision that when there are people who are involved and so deeply ingrained in the Chanukas HaMishkan, I'm on the outside, I want more. I feel bad. I'm hurt by it, not on a personal level. It's no insult. But I wish I could be involved. And Hashem responds to that. The way Rashi sounds, the Medrash sounds, it's almost as if Aaron would not have felt bad, Hashem wouldn't have responded to it. So Aaron has to trigger Hashem's response. And Hashem reminds him of the menorah. And Hashem focuses his attention on the menorah. And of course, the very famous phrase of Rashi, Shelcha gedol mishelahem. So he tells Aaron, don't worry. Your mitzvah is greater than their mitzvah. Their mitzvah are the wagons and the gold and the silver and the animals and the keteris. Your mitzvah is the menorah. Very famous kasha, the Ramban. What's the Ramban's kasha, the Hanukkah kasha? Why is Aaron's Hadlakas Menorah mitzvah in the beginning of Halascha greater than their mitzvah? They have their mitzvah, he has his mitzvah. Hashem should have told Aaron, you have a mitzvah that's yours, and they have a mitzvah that's theirs. Why is the language of the Medrash that Rashi quotes, Shelcha Gidola Mishelahem? So the famous Ramban speaks to what I spoke about yesterday. Hashem was telling Aaron, these wagons and plates and spoons, they have an expiry date. What's the expiry date? Well, the wagons expired. Once they got to Yerushalayim, they no longer need wagons. We really have no record of when these plates and spoons were no longer used, but certainly after the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, these plates and wagons and cups and spoons were buried, were ransacked, and unlike the other Klei HaMikdash that were rebuilt in the second Beis HaMikdash, there was really no reason to rebuild wagons and plates. So presumably, at the utmost, these plates and wagons and cups and spoons probably lasted until the end of the first Beis HaMikdash. Probably. Maybe not even. Maybe they were destroyed in some of the waves of paganism in the first Beis HaMikdash, where some of the Kelim were abused. Whereas your Hadlakas Menorah will have eternal durability, eternal relevance, because even after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, the Ramban says, Hashem is telling Aaron, Jews will continue to light the menorah in their homes in Galus, and that will be a memory of your menorah. So the menorah you're lighting in the Beis HaMikdash is setting a paradigm for Am Yisrael's Hadlakas Menorah and Chanukah, which I spoke about yesterday, that our Hadlakas is like Hadlakas Beis HaMikdash. Okay, so this is an easy one. I don't have to develop it as subtly as the first two messages. I've told you so often, life's about engaging in the moment, but thinking about long-term and eternity. And the moment, it seemed like those wagons were very flashy. And in the moment, it seems like those plates and silver and gold, everyone was celebrating them. The menorah is very humdrum. But Hashem is telling Aaron, your menorah is going to last and last and last and last, far beyond all this excitement and thrill and pageantry and euphoria. So invest in the long term, even if it seems a little boring, even if it seems a little routine. Very often, it's not incidental. Very often, the very fact that it's boring and routine means that it's long term. You want to build a family? You want to sit one day at a table with your children, your grandchildren at a Seder? You're going to have to be every night at home, feeding your kids, changing their diapers, giving them baths, not running from place to place, traveling either physically or emotionally across the globe. Just very simple day-to-day activities. Every day, the menorah, Paloscha Saneros, Amopene Amenari, Yerushiva Saneros, morning, Mitiva Saneros, every day the same, but Shilcha Gedola Mishalem. So three interesting messages from today's Kriyas HaTorah in Rashi. Number one, try to find that sweet spot between individuality and uniformity. Generally, the difference is behavior versus identity. Your behavior, when you're in public settings, try as hard as you can not to stand out, especially when the standing out is abrasive to others. Radical ideas, sarcasm, I'm different, I'm better, competition, superiority complex, all that stuff, but even more subtle issues. Try to see if you can be just someone that's just part of a group. And without it stripping you of your identity, without it stripping you of your individualism, try to be your own person in an honest way, but don't have to show it and flaunt it and stake out your territory and become territorial and I'm different. And that's number one. Number two, when you see people that accomplish more than you, don't be afraid to feel bad. That's the first, that's a springboard to harder work, the springboard to achievement, the springboard to perseverance. If you don't feel bad, you just excuse it away, so then you continue on your merry life of mediocrity without ever reaching and stretching for more. Feeling bad is the seed of stretching. Number three, think about long term. It may not feel as exciting in the moment, but long term, more than you can invest long term. This is like ABC. Some of you are going to finance. ABCs of investment, long-term investment. Don't play the market. Don't sell. All of a sudden, the market starts panicking. You run to your computer. Sell off all your stocks. Long-term, think about market trends. Long-term, think about developmental trends. Long-term, think about what you want to invest in. And obviously, you have to be involved in the short-term, right? You can't say, oh, long-term, I'm not going to pay my electric bill because long-term, who cares? You have to be involved in the day-to-day, but try to think about how it's going to affect the long-term more so. Okay. Let's turn our attention.